The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect. This is the programme that discusses the issues that you want to talk about if you're blind or partially sighted. I'm Stephen Scott. Hello, I'm with you for the next hour. And this week we discuss a major issue for us blind and partially sighted people, and that's shared spaces. We'll be talking to guide dog owners concerned about the rising number of such schemes across the UK. Also, we report on a campaign by Police Scotland to raise awareness of the number of attacks by dogs on assistance dogs. Also, ever wondered what RNIB Connect is all about? Well, our community reporter Danielle Colcombe has been out and about in her local area in the northwest of England to find out more about changes to the UK's leading sight loss charity. And we find out about a taxi company with a difference that takes you to and home from your destination.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
But first this week, shared spaces are back in the news again after the father of a young boy killed while walking in a shared space area took a petition demanding the end of such road schemes to Prime Minister Theresa May in Downing Street. Clinton Pringle was hit as he walked in a shared space area outside a park while on holiday with his mother. His father, Michael, is now campaigning for a moratorium on shared spaces and has joined campaigners to highlight the dangers posed to blind, partially sighted and disabled people, as well as children. Obviously, lots of you out there have views on this. Let's hear now from two people who have very strong views on shared spaces, one guide dog owner and one shared space campaigner. Angus and Louise are here. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So we're talking about shared spaces this week on The Weekly Connect, and it's a major concern for a lot of blind people. At least that's what blind people are telling us here on the show. Angus, you have had a considerable experience of shared spaces and not good ones.
No, not at all, really. I'm totally blind myself and a guide dog owner. And the basics of it are, so far as I'm concerned, that when you're working with a dog, the dog needs to have a demarcation or an understanding of what is the road and what is the pavement. And with a shared space, obviously, you can't get that because there are no curbs, or even in some cases crossings or recognised crossing points. So therefore, the dog doesn't really know where to go or what's with off limits. And that being the case, you could be putting yourself in considerable danger. So they are less than ideal.
And this is, of course, because the demarcation is pretty much taken away when it comes to shared spaces. The traffic and the pedestrians effectively live in the same space.
That's right. I think the idea was correct me if I'm wrong, I think the idea is that you make eye contact with the car drivers, and you're all using the same space, the logic is that the car drivers would slow down and be considerate to pedestrians. And the reason for doing it, as far as I understand, is that aesthetically, it looks nicer, and councils want to do this in order to make their cities and streetscapes a nicer place to be and therefore attract more people to town centres, which are struggling at present.
Okay. Louise, from your perspective, you're in Liverpool, as I mentioned, and you are concerned about upcoming shared space schemes. In fact, so much so, you've been getting involved to try and stop some of them.
Yes, that's right. Basically, I've been doing campaigning in my role. I'm a volunteer campaign coordinator for RNIB in Liverpool, and I'm registered partially sighted myself. I did this campaigning really as part of a follow-on from the general who put out their campaign of RNIB. So I wasn't campaigning about any particular shared spaces that were coming up, but I wanted to just get in as part of that campaign and try and get the council to be, you know, make sure that everybody was aware of the issues that these can present for visually impaired people, and, you know, make sure that's built into any policy if possible, and that there's, you know, consultation. So that's what I've been trying to do with this street charter that I'm getting set up here.
Yeah, but you're involved in street charter, which of course, as you say, covers a whole wide range of topics. We've discussed A-boards in the show, for example. That's a big problem for a lot of blind people. Street clutter, chairs outside cafes and tables and all of that. But these shared space schemes, do you have more concern about those than you do about street clutter, or are the concerns equal?
For me personally, I think shared space is probably more of a concern. You know, I've tried to look at it across the board, you know, and get people's views, because I think for different people, different things are more of a concern or less of a concern, you know, depending on their different eye conditions. I do, personally, I am quite concerned about shared spaces, because I just think they can be, as I see it, they seem to be potentially very dangerous, you know, with the whole thing relying on, I suppose, eye contact, as was mentioned by Angus, but I see it even goes further than that, because yeah, eye contact. I couldn't make eye contact with a driver behind a wheel. I wouldn't be able to see that there was a driver behind the wheel. But in some circumstances, I would have problems even seeing that a car was approaching from a certain distance, or, you know, in certain lighting conditions, and some people wouldn't be able to at all. You know, so it's just, the concept is based around getting rid of formal demarcations and, you know, formal traffic controls, as I understand it. And I think it's based on the idea that then people will be more considerate. But that's a lot to sort of put your faith in if you can't actually see to make that negotiation.
I mean, Angus, you've tried out these schemes, and, you know, one of the things about it that stands out for me is that it seems as if, and this is certainly the intention, I guess, is that drivers are more aware of the people around them. So in theory, it should be safer to travel down a street, to walk down a street if, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you're blind or disabled in any form or any way.
Logically, that would be the case. However, I'm not so sure. And especially if you're presented with a shared space in a strange area that's not so familiar to you, it's quite a daunting prospect. For example, I used to live in London, and I've encountered a couple of shared spaces in London, which I found almost impossible to navigate. One was near Shepherd's Bush Station, near the new Westfield Shopping Centre. And there you had, effectively, you were crossing the entrance to the bus station, but you didn't know that. There was no crossings that I was aware of, and you had buses bearing down on you, yet there were no curbs. Can you imagine how frightening that is? Also, the shared space scheme in Exhibition Road in London is quite a difficult one to navigate. What I found happened there was I was almost hugging the building line, thinking that, well, that's the safest place to be, but not quite knowing what's coming up next. And at the time when I tried it, there was no corded paving to provide an indication of where was a safe area and where wasn't. So they're not best, but the removal of crossings as well, I don't think can be overlooked, because if you're asking your dog to find a crossing and it isn't there, you're getting more frustrated with your guide dog, because you think the crossing should be there, and he or she can't find it for you because it simply isn't.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I say, as part of my work on the street charter, I did a bit of local research, just a small piece of research, and took the different views. I personally don't, I'm not a guide dog user. I don't at the moment need any aids like a cane or a guide dog, but I've got a range of views, you know, definitely that view that Angus was saying was represented about, you know, the guide dogs need the curbs to navigate, and obviously, you know, would be expecting things like crossings. As somebody that doesn't use a guide dog or a cane, my issues are more that I do need a crossing very much to cross the road, particularly if it's a busy road. I don't have the issue with the curbs, but, you know, when you take away the sort of demarcations that you expect, that can be still disorientating for me in some circumstances. Another issue, I suppose, is I don't look obviously visually impaired, and that's the same for quite a lot of other partially sighted people. So that presents another set of issues, in the sense that people won't necessarily know that I am. You know, so a driver might expect that I would be able to see them, but I wouldn't, you know, and I might not be able to see the car. So a whole range of issues, really.
Okay, thanks, Angus. Thank you, Louise, for your views on that. If you want to share your views, then we would love to hear them. You can get in touch with the show, of course. The simple way to do it is through email, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Get in touch, tell us what you think about shared spaces, and your view could be on this programme next week as we continue that conversation.
The annual general meeting of RNIB is happening on the 9th of November in London, and the Board of Trustees invites you to attend the event to help shape RNIB's future direction. The AGM provides members with an opportunity to learn more about RNIB's strategic priorities and achievements, and this year we will be making our AGM accessible to as many members as possible. You can get involved by asking a question or providing honest feedback to ensure that you have your say in how RNIB develops in the coming year. RNIB Connect Radio will be broadcasting highlights from the AGM on air, on Facebook, and podcasts will be available on demand. If you would like to attend the meeting in person, please contact the Connect team by email at connect@rnib.org.uk or by phone on 0303 1234 555 before Friday the 20th of October 2017. And if you would like to put any questions to trustees or executive directors at the AGM, the closing date is Thursday, the 2nd of November, 2017. You can post your response on the online community pages in the Play Your Part discussion board, www.rnib.org.uk/community, or call the Connect team on 0303 1234 555. Or email them at connect@rnib.org.uk.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
This is The Weekly Connect. I'm Stephen Scott. Hello. Now, an event to highlight how RNIB are now working more closely than ever with other organisations has taken place in the northwest of England. Danielle Colcombe is a community facilitator at RNIB and sent us this report.
For most of you, it won't come as a surprise that things are a little different here at RNIB. One such change has been widely publicised, and that's the merger between Action for Blind People and RNIB. It's fair to say that there was much confusion about the delivery of services from each charity, and that's why, as of the 1st of April 2017, after 7 years of working in collaboration with each other, both charities joined under the single RNIB name. A series of events were held across the northwest, in Liverpool, Manchester and Preston, which aimed to highlight the change and explain how RNIB are moving forward.
Today's event's really important because it's about introducing the new way of working to all of the local partnership organisations, our volunteers, Connect members and campaigners, so that going forward we work together much more closely.
That's Andrea Glover, who is the Northwest Network Manager for RNIB. She's also my boss, and since we've been working together, it's clear that we couldn't agree more that working together with local organisations and societies is vital to the future of RNIB. But what do those organisations think?
It's Phil Longworth, Chief Executive of Bradbury Fields, local society in Liverpool, and I'm here to find out what RNIB is doing now. Big emphasis on partnership, which is what drives me and drives our organisation, and I think is really valuable for blind and partially sighted people to hear we're all working together now. And I think it's new, it's at the start of something, we can all shape it. Love the Connect. I think Connect is the thing that brings all of it together in terms of support for ourselves, taking some responsibility instead of having everything done to us. And I think that recognising now that that's available for all agencies, bodies, individuals to contribute to is fantastic.
My name is Eamon Dunn. I work for the Thomas Pocklington Trust, specifically on the England Vision Strategy in the North, and I'm here to find out about the new structure for RNIB in the Northwest. I think it's the right way to go. It's what Thomas Pocklington Trust advocates. It's what we do. It's what organisations that we know very well, like Henshaw's, are doing more closely. I think if the sector works together more effectively, given the increasing numbers of people with sight loss that we're going to experience over the coming years, then I think we can be far more effective and hold account the statutory services more effectively as well.
Hello, my name's Scott Smith and I'm the Community Development and Partnerships Manager at the Stroke Association. We've been invited here today and it's been an absolutely great event to be able to go around to all the different tables and learn about the different areas of RNIB. We've probably spent around 10 minutes at each table, which is really good because you're able to get involved and into an in-depth conversation with each person. I've got a few leaflets, some things that I can take away to our staff meetings, so a really enjoyable day. Partnership working is the way forward. Charities, as we're aware, under increasing pressure to be able to provide under limited or decreasing resources. So why not work with each other? Why not build on each other's strengths? So an example is the Stroke Association working with RNIB. We know that a lot of people after stroke have a visual impairment or some form of sight loss. We can support them with their stroke, but why not signpost them to RNIB and allow that stroke survivor to get the best recovery that they can possibly have.
Despite all of the positivity for change at RNIB, different organisations working together in collaboration can present some challenges, as Brian from Envision explains.
We're here today to find out more what the RNIB is doing now, and I think the RNIB has been known for being a bit stuffy and old-fashioned, but hopefully now coming today we've realised that the RNIB could move forward and do new exciting things and maybe some partnership working. I think we all have to be careful of our identity because, you know, we are very protective of our own society. But we already do technology with the RNIB and that works very well, and we hope to do more things in the future. And the good thing is today as well, we got to know contacts where we can go to people to iron out certain little problems with the RNIB, and we'll move forward together, and hopefully it should be great for visually impaired people. And I think we need more visually impaired people to be ambassadors for all the different societies, because the visually impaired people know best, and I think it's about time we stopped sighted people making decisions for visually impaired people.
Ultimately, the purpose of all this change is to make lives better for blind and partially sighted people. So what do the visually impaired community think about the changes at RNIB, and how have they reacted to the news that the charity will be working more closely with other local and national organisations?
I'm Anne. I do think it's very important that we work in partnership with other organisations. It's no good us all doing either little bits in silos. It's no good us doing little bits that might be the same. But actually, if we work together, we can create a really strong network of support for people. And that's what I think we should be doing. That can only benefit blind and partially sighted people. And what will benefit blind and partially sighted people even more is to make them part of what we're doing by communicating with them and actually have them working with us on what we're doing right from the beginning.
My name is Laurel Devi. I'm a service user at Galloway's and a volunteer also. And it's been very useful to find out what's going on with RNIB and how they're going to work together with Galloway's to promote eye health, and my particular interest is prevention. There's too much potential for duplication of services, and it means that in a period of austerity, the money can be targeted better if the RNIB work with the small blind societies.
Connecting with one another was a strong theme that emerged throughout the events, and is something that blind and partially sighted people certainly want more of. And that's what RNIB Connect is ultimately all about. If you don't already know, Connect in its simplest form is a network of blind and partially sighted people, their friends, family and supporters. Everyone who takes part can find support, information and opportunities to influence and shape the work that we do. Phil Longworth from Bradbury Fields feels it's a good thing.
I think if I look at Connect and what does that mean for me personally with a sight problem, it actually gives me a forum to get information very quickly. I love the succinctness of the way it's presented. Not a lot of hours in today just to get drowned with talking things at me. So that's really, really good. As an organisation, I think at the moment we probably don't know an awful lot about it, because I think it's changing as it evolves. So I think great stuff to come and talk to us certainly, but other organisations as well. And I think in terms of partnership for me, it's simply about, yes, we work for individual organisations and there's a history to all of that. You don't want to lose any history, but you want to use the resources more effectively to deliver better services and more combined services. And when I say better in some ways, it's not saying that any services that went before weren't good, because they were great, but we had a bit more money before. We've not got as much money now, so it's using that money more effectively.
The VIBs are a sports and social group that has been set up to support visually impaired and blind people across Manchester. I spoke to three of their members about why it's useful to make connections.
My name's Liam Dempsey. I'm from Middleton in Manchester. I'm part of the Great Manchester VIB Sports and Social Group, and I'm involved in football and social events, and I've been involved in since 2010.
What have you got out of the afternoon?
What I've got out of the afternoon, I've met loads of new people, and I've interacted with other people who are visually impaired, and I've got to know about services that I didn't know was available to me.
I'm Ruth from Manchester again, one of the Greater Manchester VIBs and Sports and Social Club. I don't actually do the sports, I take more in the social side of things and trying to connect people. So the R&IB Connect is particularly informative for me, and that's a good useful tool that we'll be making the most of. The technology was interesting to pass on information things, but I'm not a technology person. But even so, it's good to be able to pass that information on to other people who do need to know what's happening. And yeah, all the services and that were there, it's just good to be kept up to date.
Hey, I'm Rachel. I'm from Stockport. I'm also part of the VIB's group, Sport and Social. I take part in blind football and goalball sessions, and I also help arrange and organise the social events that take place across Greater Manchester. Today's been good. Got to know a lot of people, took away some people's emails and telephone numbers, and the services are there, got a bit more out of it, information and just finding out what's new, what's out there, and how we can pass, as our group, can pass information on to other service users so they can then be involved if they want to be with R&IB Connect and the other services that are here.
Following a successful event in the northwest of England, my colleagues and I are looking forward to engaging with more of you out there. So if you want more information or if you want to get involved, please email the team at connectnorthwest@rnib.org.uk.
Many thanks to Daniel Colcombe there for that report from the northwest of England. Now, this is the Weekly Connect. It's the programme where you get the chance to talk about the issues you want to talk about. Claire has been in touch to tell us her big issue, and it's all about labelling.
Hello everyone, my name's Claire and I'm 17. I'm totally blind and I'm a braille user. My big issue is when people go in shops and find braille on products like bleach, thick bleach especially, or things like medication, but it's not found on things like tins or bottles of, for example, shampoos and conditioners, which quite often come in the same shape bottles but a different product inside. So I want to know, why can't braille be put on other products as well as bleach and medication? Because that's just a small change that can make a big difference to quite a lot of blind and partially sighted people's lives, so that people don't end up having cat food instead of tomato soup for the tea, or they don't end up buying conditioner instead of shampoo.
Okay, thanks Claire, good question. Well, let's ask James Bowden from R&IB about this. James, you're the product manager for Braille, so you know a thing or two, certainly about Braille. Why do companies pick and choose what products they put Braille on?
So the basic thing is there is no mandatory requirement to label anything in Braille, except for pharmaceutical packages where there's an EU directive.
Interesting. So there is no UK law, certainly.
Not as far as I'm aware. That's correct, yeah.
Wow.
Interestingly, though, this is something that Claire didn't mention in her piece. If you go to the Co-op, their own brand products in boxes do have Braille on them. So if you buy, for example, Co-op cornflakes, you'll find on the back of that, it'll say Co-op cornflakes 500 grams or whatever, which I think is really interesting.
Yes, so the Co-op have, as you say, their own branded products have got some Braille on them. I mean, it's not not everything is in Braille on those products. You know, it's not going to give you all the full ingredients or calorie information.
That's right. It's normally just a couple of lines. You know, it might say, I don't know, oatmeal biscuits.
Yeah, but that's all Claire's wanting, isn't it? She just wants to differentiate.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, it would be absolutely wonderful if other supermarkets could follow the Co-op's lead, especially that some of the big food manufacturers as well.
Is this something that R&IB has been or is getting involved in?
That's a very good question, and I have personally mentioned it to campaigns, so maybe people might want to get in touch with our campaigns department, and if sufficient people get in touch, perhaps they might do something, yeah.
Okay, well, it sounds like a good idea to get people involved in order to start a campaign around this, perhaps. Maybe it's something that people want. And as you say, you know, we all should get together and put our voice to this if we feel strongly about it. Of course, there are some people who might say, James, well, I don't read Braille, so what about me?
Well, I was going to come on to sort of what to do in the meantime, or some ideas what you can do in the meantime to avoid getting dog food when you wanted tomato soup. And I have to do this myself as a visually impaired person. When I go shopping, I always ask the shop assistant. I'm one of these people who actually goes to a shop and goes around with an assistant.
Oh, you're one of them, are you?
I'm one of those, yeah. I like to actually see what I'm getting. I mean, yeah. You know, if you say to me 500 grams of carrots, is that a big bag or a small bag? You know, so I like to actually see what I'm getting. And yeah, there have been horror stories. I'm sure we've all got our horror stories of supermarkets in the past, but let's not go there. And what I do, for example, let's assume I want to buy a tin of tomatoes and a tin of baked beans, for example. I will ask the assistant to show me the tins as I get them off the shelf, or as she gets them off the shelf, or as he gets them off the shelf. And then I'll say, look at any features those tins might have. So, for example, the tin of beans might have a ring pull on it, and the tin of tomatoes might not have a ring pull on it. Now, that one's an easy one, but what if they both look identical? What I do is I either put a little rip in the label and saying, you know, is it okay if I just rip the label here? I'm still going to buy it. It's not going to harm the barcode, is it? Or another one is you could put an elastic band around it. You know, you can have one band, two bands, three bands, and then just remember which way they are. They're all very low-tech solutions to this problem. There are higher-tech solutions as well. You can, for example, use the PenFriend labeler. It's a very popular product to put labels on things. You're not sure which ones they are. And then you can just use the PenFriend machine and say, what's that? Other people might use, if you have an iPhone, some of the apps there, like the KNFB reader, you can say, what's this label say? And it'll tell you.
Incredible. So there are ways around it. There are ways to sort of hack your way into this information that we need to find. Really interesting, James. Thank you for coming on and telling us that. I'm sure Claire will be very appreciative of it.
I hope so. Yeah.
Now let's have a look at what's happening this week at RNIB. This week at RNIB, a new report is warning that one in five people will live with sight loss in their lifetime in the UK, despite at least half of all cases being avoidable. State of the Nation Eye Health 2017 is published by RNIB and High Street Opticians Specsavers and is a benchmark of Britain's current eye health. RNIB and Specsavers have been working together since 2016 to raise awareness of the importance of eye health at every level and help prevent avoidable sight loss. TV presenter Anne Robinson is supporting RNIB and Specsavers as an eye health ambassador and brings her own personal experience to the campaign.
I don't know why we didn't know all, I didn't know all this and realise the importance, even with the experience I'd had with my dad. Just, I can remember now standing in the optician with him and hearing this news. He had two cataracts and I felt I should have been looking after him. And certainly as a granny now with two grandchildren, you know, after the age of three, my small shouty people should be having their eyes tested.
Also this week, eye health professionals are now using a new Certificate of Vision Impairment form when certifying people as blind or partially sighted in England. The revamped form aims to provide councils with better information to ensure that people who are newly diagnosed are put in contact with the most relevant local sources of help. The biggest changes are that there are no longer two separate CVI forms for certifying adults and children. The new form has combined data fields and the single form will be used for all patients. Also, a copy of the CVI form can be provided to the patient in an accessible format of their choice. Deputy Director of RNIB, Fasili Hadi, is encouraging people living with a sight condition to get themselves registered.
People want to go through all the medical procedures they can because people want to retain sight. But at some point, even though you're trying different treatments, I think it is worth asking for the certificate or whether you're ready for the certificate, because there's nothing to stop you carrying on with the treatments, but actually you might need support in the home, and that can only be given to you by local government and charities. And filling in that form is a kind of bell that tells the support services that you might need a bit of help around the home, you might need some training in how to get around more easily, or in living independently in your home.
This week is Remember a Charity in Your Will Week, an event that aims to raise awareness of one of the ways you can donate to charity through your will. 190 charities are now involved in the annual campaign, and organisers are hoping that this year's Awareness Week will take us a step forward to making gifts in our wills a social norm. Daniel Pepper is the Legacies Administration Manager for RNIB and says making a will is easier than you might think.
I think for most people, it is a little bit of a daunting process. It is actually very straightforward. We always recommend that you take independent legal advice when making or changing a will. It is the most important document most people will ever sign, apart from a mortgage document, when buying their homes. And it is a wonderful document that gives everybody peace of mind once it's done. The easiest thing is, if you have a local family solicitor, is to get a quote. Most solicitors now do very, very good rates for wills and will do home visits, which is much more relaxing for the individual. It means that they don't have to go to the office. They're relaxed at home. They can feel they can talk more freely at home. And most solicitors now offer that service.
An all-party parliamentary group has been set up to investigate problems with capacity within NHS eye care services in England. The inquiry is looking into how national and local health commissioning can work to ensure capacity meets demand for eye health services. The inquiry also seeks to identify the barriers and opportunities to helping prevent avoidable sight loss. RNIB is acting as the secretariat for the APPG inquiry. The charity's eye health policy manager is Helen Lee, and told us why capacity is such an issue and what could be done to solve the problem.
It takes a long time, as you can imagine, for consultant ophthalmologists to train and to gain all the experience they require and need. So it's not possible to increase the workforce of consultant ophthalmologists instantly. That's not possible. But what services across the UK have been doing is looking at imaginative ways of making the best use of the workforce to try and tackle the capacity issue. So, for example, ophthalmic nurses, optometrists and others are taking on some of the tasks, being trained and skilled to take on some of the tasks that previously perhaps doctors would have taken on. So there are imaginative ways that the services are looking to address this issue.
And finally, disability campaigners are celebrating after Bradford councillors voted to ban A-boards from public pavements across the district, marking a victory in what became a year-long campaign. The council's executive had earlier this year opted against a ban, but the Health and Social Care Overview and Scrutiny Committee had then taken the extremely rare step of quashing the decision and asking the full council to vote on the matter instead. Opposition councillors called on the authority to do more to help businesses whose trade could be hit by the decision. Jessica Hall works in RNIB's campaigns team and explains what happens next.
Our next step is to ask Bradford Council to adopt the RNIB Street Charter. So not just stopping with A-boards, but carrying on to get Street Charter embedded into the council's policies, which is great, fantastic work and a great success in Bradford.
And that's this week at RNIB. Now, dog owners across Scotland are being warned they could face criminal charges if their dog attacks an assistance dog. Police Scotland has published a film highlighting the impact of a dog attacking a registered assistance dog and reminding the public and its officers of the seriousness with which such an incident will be treated. From January 2016 to September 2017, 25 dogs from guide dogs in Scotland were attacked by other canines. 9 animals had to undergo vet treatment, leaving their owners without their lifeline support during the recovery period. That's what happened to Elaine McKenzie's guide dog, Una.
I was doing some shopping in a local supermarket and I'd come through the checkout, was getting ready to leave, when what I can only describe as a thing came hurtling towards us. Una started screaming which is a really horrible sound. Members of the public were trying to get this thing, which I then realised was a Staffordshire Bull Terrier. They were trying to get the dog off her. Weren't succeeding. The dog had actually been tied to the container that empty baskets go in. So obviously when it came in, that came in with it. Members of the public were actually hitting the dog with it. Eventually the owner turned up, got the dog off Una. And when I looked down, there was a pool of blood on the supermarket floor and this dog's muzzle in the pool of blood. Una had quite a few fairly deep puncture wounds to her neck and to her chest. I think because she was in harness, it did actually save her, because the dog sort of couldn't really get hold of, you know, a lot of bits of her.
In the majority of cases, most of the aggressor dogs were not on a lead or tied up when the incidents happened, with all but one of the attacks happening in a public place. Four people were also hurt in the attacks, while 19 owners were left emotionally affected by the incidents. Police Scotland say that while the number of attacks are low, the impacts are real. Chief Superintendent John McKenzie.
The numbers aren't large in terms of, the statistics indicate 25 attacks that have been reported over the last year or so. However, it's the impact that it has on owners, the impact it has on communities, and actually by removing the lifeline of an assistance dog actually has a significant impact on the owner and their ability to function within the communities that they serve, they work, they socialise.
Police Scotland is publishing a film highlighting the impact of a dog attacking a registered assistance dog and reminding the public and its officers of the seriousness with which such an incident would be treated. Guide dog owner Elaine McKenzie is featured in the video. She says it took a lot of time for her and her dog Una to build up enough confidence to head back out together.
3 months later, after only being able to wander about in my local area, which meant like round the block, we ventured further and we kept at it till about 6 months after the attack. I was actually able to go a bit further, go uptown and things. It must have been, I would say, 9 months, a year, before she was confident enough to go back to that supermarket and actually allow me to do some shopping in there.
As a result of changes to Section 3 of the Dangerous Dogs Act in Scotland, that's the 1991 Act, any person in charge of a dog, whether they are its owner or not, can be charged if the dog in their care attacks an assistance dog. Chief Superintendent John McKenzie says there are a range of penalties which are dependent on the case.
On cases, it can be a maximum fine up to £300. But if the case was deemed significant enough to be heard on summary, there's potentially up to 6 months imprisonment, or it can be heard on petition. But I suppose the normal circumstances would be a fine. However, it's not just the monetary impact, it's the impact it has on the owner, whose dog could potentially be removed from them as well.
Niall Foley is Guide Dog Scotland's engagement manager and says the impact of an attack can be life-changing.
We've heard particularly the most extreme cases where a guide dog hasn't been able to work for a number of weeks. There have been cases where literally that person's daily lifeline out and about, whether it's work, doctor's appointments or so on, has been severely affected. And that's at the most extreme end. At the other end, we also have a message that we encourage dog owners to be responsible when they see an assistance dog, particularly if they see an assistance dog that's working in harness, to give the dog room to do its job, to give them the respect it deserves, and not let their dog interfere with an assistance dog. Where there's a persistent problem, that can have a negative impact on, say, a particular journey.
Niall also welcomes the partnership and support of Police Scotland and their efforts to highlight this issue.
The support of Police Scotland is massively important to us in this campaign. The Police Scotland have been tremendously supportive, not only in our work supporting guide dog owners on an individual level, but now with this training video and public-facing partnership to raise our key messages of responsible dog ownership. And it's fantastic to have them on board and to know that rank and file officers will have an understanding, not just of the law, but an empathic understanding of what guide dog owners are going through when an attack on assistance dog is reported to them by a member of the public.
Despite the best efforts of everyone involved in highlighting these problems, the reality of living through such an attack cannot be overemphasised. Lynn McKenzie says her dog Una still suffers today.
If she sees a dog she doesn't like, she'll come right in beside my legs. So I know that there's something she doesn't like. If we're in the park and she sees a dog she doesn't like, I tell her, go run. I know she's seen something by her body language. She'll take herself off maybe 20 yards and she'll wait till I whistle her back. So 6 years later, it's still actually impacting on our daily lives.
And she offers this important advice to dog owners.
Put your dog on a lead and have it on a short lead. If a member of the public could, if they knew their dog was going to react, obviously try and cross the road. Don't allow your dog to actually come right up to an assistance dog. Keep your distance.
And if you would like to share your thoughts on this story or any other you've been listening to here on The Weekly Connect, please do get in touch. You can email us theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. Now, let's catch up on some events coming up around the UK. An Eye Health Information Day is at St George's Church in Kemp Town in Brighton on Monday the 18th of September from 10:30 till 4 p.m. The venue is close to Sussex Eye Hospital and assistance can be provided to and from the nearest bus stops. Drinks and refreshments are also available, so whether you have a visual impairment or know someone who does, or you just want to learn what you can do to keep your eyes healthy, it offers the chance to find out more about what's available in your area. There will be equipment on show as well as professionals available to help you give advice and help overcome some of the issues relating to sight loss. Sighted guides will be on hand to offer assistance where required. And for further information, go to this website, ESCIS, that's escis.org.uk. Now, on Saturday, the 16th of September, at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry, E. Nesbitt's classic novel, The Railway Children, is being brought thrillingly to life in a stunning new stage production, which is audio described. Now, for further information, including the availability of introductory notes and touch tours, call this number, 024 7655 3055. That's 024 7655 3055. Or go to the website belgrade.co.uk. Now, if you'd like your event added to the guide, then you can email us at theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, taxis are great, aren't they? And they're particularly great for getting about quickly, especially if you're blind or partially sighted. However, they aren't always the answer for some of us, especially elderly people, even young children. And that's why a taxi company with a difference called Driving Miss Daisy has been launched. It began life initially in New Zealand, but is now operating in the UK. Jocelyn Close set up its first UK franchise in Surrey. It's going really well, and she now mentors others to achieve the same as she's achieved. And she spoke to RNIB Connect Radio's Red Sail.
Driving Miss Daisy started with a lovely lady in New Zealand called Mel Harper. She used to drive her Aunt Trish about, and Aunt Trish was always dependent on Mel driving her around and always felt indebted to Mel. So one day she decided she was going to ask her neighbour to drive her around and she'd pay her neighbour. This would give Aunt Trish her independence back. Mel realised this is a fantastic service and started Mel Harper Driving Services in Havelock North on the east coast of New Zealand. Business grew, and it got to a point where her and her husband Jack decided that it needed to expand. And they, from the film, which stars Morgan Freeman and Jessica Tandy, came up with the name of Driving Miss Daisy, offering a service primarily for the elderly or anyone who needs to remain independent, a companion driving service. When looking into it, they realised that The operation of Driving Miss Daisy had already launched in Canada in 2002 by a wonderful lady called Bev Helinski. She set up with a prime aim of providing a meaningful and rewarding service to seniors in St. Alberta. The demand for her service grew and grew, and now in Canada, her service is branching into Ontario, Alberta, and BC. Jacamel flew over to Canada to meet the wonderful Bev Helinski, and Bev persuaded Jacamel to launch Driving Miss Daisy in New Zealand. This was in 2008, and now Driving Miss Daisy has over 60 franchises in New Zealand, offering a wonderful companion driving service to anyone that needs to remain independent.
And when did you set up the first franchise over here in the UK?
The business came over to the UK and launched in spring 2015.
And obviously it's going well down in Surrey. And is it spreading across the country?
We provide this wonderful service across the UK. We have nearly 40 franchises across the UK. This expansion has happened just in the past 2 years. And we are bringing on new franchisees every month. And the business is growing. And each franchise is growing. Our franchise now has 3 vehicles. One has a wheelchair accessible vehicle, so we can keep more people independent.
And has it proved to be popular with blind and partially sighted people?
We have a very close relationship with the Blind Veterans Association and the Macular Society. Our franchise, for example, we take a group of people from the Macular Society to their weekly meetings. And the difference of the service that we offer is that our cars are all blue and branded with big daisies on the side. Our drivers are all in uniform and we greet the client at the front door. We give them any assistance they need into our car. If they have walkers and wheelchairs, we pop those in the boot as well. Nothing's too much trouble. They sit in the front, we chat away with them like a member of the family, and then when we get to their destination, we take the client in and ensure they're in the right place and ensure that they're comfortable. Or it may be that we take people shopping. We have one client who is registered blind and we take her shopping, and this enables her to get the brand of peaches that she loves. It enables her to get the longest sell-by dates on her products that she wants to have. We then take her round. She gets her shopping. People have so much trust in us that they trust us to help them with paying for their shopping. Then we go back and we help unload their shopping into their kitchen and check that they're comfortable back at home.
I noticed that one of your slogans is when family can't be there. And certainly that, you know, comes through from what you're saying, that not only are your drivers, but they're carers. Presumably there's a different cost scale for the taxi aspect and the carer aspect.
All our daisies, those are our drivers, all our daisies are private hire licensed. So we offer a service where the client has pre-quoted and a pre-booked service. So before they leave their house, they know exactly how much their journey's going to cost. And it'll be an amalgamated price of driving and companionship. So if they wanted us to drive them to the hospital, go in with them to their appointment, take notes for them during their appointment and drive them back home again, they would have a fixed cost for that whole service.
And if the appointment overruns by 3/4 of an hour, as it sometimes does?
They are, absolutely. Particularly eye hospital appointments for some reason. They understand that there is a cost for every 15 minutes of our time on from that. Unlike a care company where you have to put hours of our time, we do it in chunks of 15 minutes. So the client is fully aware of the costs that they'll have to pay for.
And presumably if the client is quite happy to be left at the appointment by themselves and your driver goes off, your daisy goes off to do another job, then you just prearrange a time to come and pick up and it can work like that.
It can. We do prearrange. Then it takes the stress out of the client having to rephone, or we go to the receptionist. When we arrive at the clinic, we go to the receptionist and say, how long will this be? Not too sure. Well, here's our card. Please phone us when Mrs. X or Mr. Y has finished and then we'll come back. So it completely takes the pressure off the client to make their journey as enjoyable and stress-free as possible.
Now, one of the perennial problems with taxi services is that though they're meant to take guide dogs, quite often you'll find drivers who are claimed to be allergic to dogs or whatever. I take it that isn't so much of a problem with Driving Miss Daisy.
Not at all. We love taking guide dogs. In fact, one of our points that we sell is we take pets to vets with or without their owners. So we offer that service as well, which actually is used enormously, or pets to the groomers. So I would say in our franchise, we're going to the vets several times a month with dogs, cats. So no, we love guide dogs.
Fantastic. Well, that'll be music to many listeners' ears. How do I go about finding out whether there is a franchise in my part of the UK?
We have a central number that you can call. And when you get to the lovely team on this central number, they will tell you the number of your nearest Daisy. We then contact that Daisy for you, and the Daisy will then contact you directly. So you just have to make one phone call to the head office number, and they will direct your call and get the Daisy to call you.
So it's all done by phone rather than needing to navigate a website, which might be quite difficult for some of us to use.
You can do either. The phone is manned 5 days a week and messages are picked up at the weekend and forwarded to the nearest Daisy, or you can go onto the website. So both are accessible to people that, depending on their requirements.
So is there a waiting list of people who are hoping that a franchise is going to open in their area?
As you can imagine, yes, there is. The demand for our service with the ageing population and more people living with dementia and more people understanding that this service is for people who don't have family nearby who can help them. Yes, there is a huge demand for the service, and particularly with busy parents, with children to and from school or children who are disabled, we offer that service as well for them. So yes, the demand is definitely out there and growing.
And how do you go about selecting your drivers? What's the typical driver that you have working for you?
They just have to be absolutely lovely. That is really the main asset and characteristic. They have to be very patient, they have to be understanding, they have to love working with people, they have to show a lot of empathy and have a good sense of humour as well, to be able to navigate themselves through people who are living with anxiety, people who are elderly, young. But on the whole, they just have to be really lovely and love working with people, and very caring and very empathetic.
I guess actually what ends up happening is that the same driver ends up driving the same clients around, and a relationship builds up between them. So one of my great problems is I can't drive my children backwards and forwards to where they want to go, and it would be lovely to have a trusted driver who I knew that they would be safe with.
Absolutely. And those relationships that are built up are lovely, and some of the feedback we get from clients is superb. Then Daisies are often invited in for cups of tea as that relationship builds, and we get little thank you notes from children. So no, that is a lovely part of the job, is to receive these lovely forms of praise from our clients as those relationships build up. And the client really values that, because they know the same person's picking them up, they know the same car's picking them up, they know the car, how it works, they know the Daisy, they get to understand how that Daisy works with them and vice versa, and it's a lovely thing that can be built up.
Fantastic. And if, as sometimes happens, the Daisy is running late, I take it there's a system where you call ahead just to say, you know, don't worry, we'll be there in 10 minutes' time.
Absolutely. We always do that. One of our strap lines is we're never late. However, things happen. Even if we are 5 minutes late, we phone ahead. Because if somebody is waiting outside because they want to, 5 minutes is a long time to wait outside. If you're elderly or if you're unsure what time the person's coming, we always phone ahead and get a message to the client. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, yes, we absolutely make sure the client is fully aware of what's going on.
Well, that's very reassuring. As I said to a taxi driver who wanted to drop me in at the end of the road because he had his next pickup to do, dropping me 20 yards from my house or 200 miles from my house. It's the same thing. I need door-to-door service. And it sounds like Driving Miss Daisy fulfills that need for me and many other blind and visually impaired people.
Yes, indeed. We offer this lovely, reliable companionship service. And yes, we are like a family member. We would take you door to door with full reassurance and provide you with independence and peace of mind.
Well, I'll be giving that phone number a call and signing up. Jocelyn Close, thank you ever so much for coming into the studio and carry on the good work.
Thank you for having me.
Now, if you want to contact Driving Miss Daisy, the number is 0333 014 6211. That number again is 0333 014 6211. And their website address for more inquiries, really easy. It is drivingmissdaisy.co.uk.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Give a little time, make a big difference. RNIB's amazing volunteers help us reach the people who need us most. We need your skills, expertise and passion so that together we can support blind and partially sighted people to live confident, independent lives. Volunteering your time for us is a great way to meet people, learn new skills and expand your horizons. We have more than 100 different volunteering opportunities across the UK. If you only have a few hours to spare, we'll have something to suit you. Why not give it a try? Visit rnib.org.uk/volunteering or call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 and help us make every day better for people affected by sight loss.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
Now, if you're blind or partially sighted, RNIB is your organisation. Sally Harvey, RNIB's Chief Executive, wants to hear from you with the questions she would like you to ask or comments that you'd like to make about RNIB and the work we all do to make life every day better for blind and partially sighted people. Now, to put your question to Sally in our upcoming special programme, you can send your comments by the 15th of September, that's Friday the 15th, to radio@rnib.org.uk. You can also tweet us at RNIB Radio or you can give us a call on this number, 0141 357 3518. Make sure you get your voice heard and join the conversation with Sally Harvey, the Chief Exec of RNIB, here on RNIB Connect Radio. And that's it for the Weekly Connect for this week. If you want your voice in the programme, do get in touch. theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk is our email address. When it's Monday at 1 o'clock, it's the Weekly Connects. We'll see you next time.